WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 W. ATD on your special Patriots Day episode. And we get a little bit of a, can you not hear yourself? Is it too low? One, two, three. Can you not hear? Can you not hear? One, two, three.
I can't hear through the headphones.
No.
But I could hear everyone else. I just can't hear you.
You can't hear
can
me.
Can you hear me through the
one,
headphones?
One, two. I think okay. I can hear me.
Okay.
All right. Just doing quality control here, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen who tuned in. This is a live show, as you can tell, as we're sitting here going, I can't hear each other. The voice you heard, co-host extraordinaire, Kathy Lanastra, state representative.
Hello, hello, hello.
Peter Brown, also serving in the co-host role. He's staying for the evening.
Yep.
And staying until 7 o'clock will be state representative Allison Sullivan.
Yeah. Hey. How Kathy is doing a great job at this.
She is.
And I've decided she's jelly. I got to be peanut butter. It's, you know.
There was a debate about
it. There was a debate about
that.
There
was a debate.
I'm fine with jelly. You fine with jelly? I'm fine with jelly. Okay, good. Jelly spikes my sugars. That was a good one.
is this the first time you've been on in a while? Yes?
Yeah, I think so.
When was the last time you were? Was it prior to the new year?
Yeah. I would think so.
It was
yeah.
right after she got married.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Now I'm having a baby.
Yeah.
Wow.
Lots changed. Thank you.
That's fantastic. And it's first.
Yes.
So you're going to go from being everybody's favorite aunt to...
Hopefully a favorite mom.
Definitely. So the first segment, of course, will be a State House report with a peanut butter jelly. State Representative Allison Sullivan Almeida and State Rep... Kathy Lanastra. Peter Brown here. Peter Brown's going to be giving us a little bit of an insight into a couple of things going on in the town of Pembroke.
Yep.
Not only the Pembroke Chamber of Commerce, right? Are you the president of said?
Yeah, the Pembroke Chamber, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we're also going to talk a little bit about what's going on with the public safety building.
Yes.
Any updates? I think there's going to be a little bit of a forum. Folks going to chat that up.
Yes. Yep. That's coming up, right, Peter?
Yep. May 2nd at my shop.
Yep. And you get annual town meeting a week later.
I know.
Now, is this safety building forum?
That's going
to
be...
kind of better inform folks for town meeting?
Yes. Yeah.
You think this will be the big ticket item that everybody's going to want to talk about?
It was one of the last town meetings my dad got to go to when they bought that corner property. And it's always been, that's been where they wanted that public safety building, and we finally got both chiefs have agreed that one building should be built. So they've done a great job informing the community, and this is going to be one last push, so hopefully we'll get it passed.
Very nice. Hour number two, Casey Sherman, who has been here previously, a New York Times best-selling author. We're going to talk with him a little bit about it being the 10-year anniversary of the Boston
yes.
Marathon bombing. Both Casey and his writing partner, Dave Wedge, wrote an article for the Boston Magazine just a few days ago about the bombing, talking with folks, recollecting who are connected to folks who either injured, who lost their lives during this. As we know, five individuals did lose their lives. We'll talk with Casey about that. I think we all want to share our thoughts on the 10-year anniversary. Also talk with them in regards to some events that he's got coming up. He's got a Hunting Whitey event coming up at the Wilbur Theater. This is kind of an action, what they're doing, take their book and they're turning it into a on-stage performance.
Fascinating.
Fantastic. I'll talk a little bit about Helltown, which is going to be out in paperback, but it's also being turned into an Amazon Studios TV series. I know, I so much paperwork. This is the research that I share with you, Kathy.
And I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
So we're going to talk about that. And then our last guest, John Paul, host of WATD's The Car Doctor. And this is a chance for us to talk about a couple of different things. Buying a used car. What is that like these days? Being careful if you are going to buy a used vehicle, some of the things you have to worry about. Getting ready to go on a trip this summer, maybe some of the things you want to kind of keep in mind when it comes to your vehicle, and much more. So that's all coming up in just a bit. We can kind of jump right into it as to how are things with you ladies. I know both of you are on the Ways and Means Committee. What has that been like?
Would you like to start, Representative Almeida?
So, thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Bring it on, Jelly.
it's been interesting, being in my third term in office, being able to see firsthand how each of these hearings go and to really kind of see the Commonwealth as well. I mean, I've been to places that I haven't been before because of the meetings where they do these around the state hearings, which I think is also important because not every time is it easy for people to get to Boston, and that commute in and out of Boston can be difficult for so many people across the Commonwealth. So got to go out to Amherst again. Last time I was out in Amherst was, I think, when we did our legislative
rep school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So being able to go back out there and see the campus was nice and see what they have done. And the food was always good.
The food was really good there. That was the best, well, not the best thing. I mean, we traveled across the Commonwealth to hear these hearings. We had Health and Human Services, Public Safety, lots of different state agencies that testified and really talked about their budget and what funds they needed and why they needed them. So that was really interesting. But we had reps would host us in their district.
Yep.
So they would try to one-up each other with lunch. So that was always a hit.
Was there a memorable lunch? Is it something like
See, now you're putting us on the spot to have our colleagues know.
When we went to, was it Arlington? It wasn't Arlington.
Arlington, didn't we have the
it was like a
barbecue food. They had really good mac and cheese.
That was good.
Yes, they had really good mac and cheese there.
Tis the time for comfort food.
It was the time for comfort food. It was a rotten day that day, too. It rained, so that was a perfect lunch for us that day.
Yep.
What is it like to serve on this committee, especially knowing that this is going to be the first budget of the new administration?
Well, not only. I mean, it's an honor to serve on the Ways and Means Committee, definitely. And it is very busy. So everything was grouped because the governor had a little extra time to do her budget this year.
Which you and I weren't used to because we came in on under Baker's administration, who has already been there for 4 years. So he didn't get as long time to put out a budget, kind of that beginning legislative process, where under the new administration, they had a longer window, which means we have a shorter window, which means cramming in all those meetings. Yes, yeah. Even, when I was reaching out to my towns, and then probably for you too, Kathy, I felt like I was under the wire, and it was the first year, even when we were during COVID and everything else, it was the first year where I was like, why do I feel like I'm so rushed at trying to get budget priorities for my local communities? And now, understanding that we didn't have as much time with the budget, we didn't have as much time with knowing what we're looking at as far as outside sections for our local communities, that was definitely different.
It was different. And these hearings were 8 hours long, hours long. We were at, was it Fitchburg? Where were we? What was the last one? Started at 11, ended at 7:30 p.m. It was a 2.5-hour ride. So these were long, and they were three a week. So they were long weeks.
Who was
thank God for Matt. Matt Muratori.
Yes.
Shout out to
Matt Muratori. He drove.
He's listening. Matt's listening. Yeah. Matt, yes. He always listens to this radio show.
He was so generous at driving the two of us and letting us carpool with him. Yeah. And never once, you know, complained about driving.
Never complained. Was never rushed you.
No.
You can tell he's a father of six girls.
Yeah.
You can tell he's a girl dad. He is so patient.
Oh yeah.
Because I have carpooled with other representatives who I shall not name who are not as patient.
I bet I can guess. I bet we could all guess in this room who we're talking about.
So what was some of the information you're gathering? Who are the individuals that you are listening to so you can be able to document and put this forth when it comes putting together the House budget?
Yeah, I mean, we listen to the administration. We listen to the constitutional officers. We've listened to the secretariats and their undersecretariats, as well as individuals within, I think, certain core focus groups, right? So whether it be higher education, we listen to several different people regarding higher education and what that needs to look like in this budget cycle. We've heard from also, when you think about Health and Human Services, we've also heard from DCF. We've heard from some of the coalitions regarding domestic violence and sexual assaults. Yeah. We've heard from
persons with disabilities.
Yep, the disability groups. And then we also heard from the public. You know, the last hearing was in Boston with the public and really getting more of individual constituents.
And there were 200 testimonies the last hearing from the public. 200 people had signed up. A wonderful thing that has happened out of COVID, which is one of the things, is we can do it virtually as well. So we have in-person hearings, but they can also testify virtually.
Hybrid,
which is fascinating. And it's also so, like Allison had said, if you live in Western Mass and you're going to drive all the way to the State House and wait there for 4 hours before you can testify and then have to drive 3 hours back, we've eliminated that. So it gives access to so many more people.
To give a 3-minute testimony, you know, or a 5-minute testimony. It's not like you have all day to testify. You know, you have a certain, you know, specific
time. Depends
on
the chairman. It's supposed to be 3 minutes, yeah.
Right, but, you know, I think also, too, when you're thinking about the public who drive from far, you want to give them a little bit more, especially when it's near and dear to their heart. You know, we heard from several people at the, you know, the public comment about disabilities and the different needs in the disability communities and some of the things that, like, I didn't even fully understand or know about, you know, with, if you remember, like, the court interpreters regarding sign language and not necessarily always having a interpreter on hand or available when you're dealing with sign language. And, you know, the deaf community, their need of having the resources that everyone else does.
Indeed.
Correct. Yes.
You know, they should
yes.
be just as important as if you're doing a language interpreter, you know, with signs. And so
how many more, speaking of languages, how many more have been introduced in the Commonwealth that we do not have interpreters for?
Right, that we're kind of spot fitting with other languages that may be able to understand or maybe not fully certified, because to be able to be certified as an interpreter is actually very lengthy as well. But it's just mind-blowing when you think about it.
Peter, do you have a question?
So what was the most interesting testimonies that you heard on the public hearings?
For me, is Health and Human Services.
Yeah.
You know, hearing about our mental health needs, speaking about the hospitals and what their needs are and how actually healthcare has changed dramatically over the last decade. And even before, we've said this before, you know, before the pandemic, we were in trouble, and then that just exacerbated it. You know, we're really in trouble in healthcare.
Yeah. Now we're seeing it more, especially with the mental health issue.
Yes.
Because people lost that opening when COVID, because everybody became shut ins. And now trying to get them out and get that help that they need, it's hard to navigate.
And not having enough practitioners.
Yes, exactly.
You know, everybody said before the pandemic, we would say we needed more beds, right? We have some beds, but we don't have the practitioners to be able to fill those beds.
Right.
And when you hear people testifying and you're hearing this, it's frightful. Right. It's frightful.
Well, they're doing that online thing for them.
I've heard a lot of that.
Yeah, and it's good in certain areas, but
It's not.
No.
Yeah, you're talking about telehealth.
Yeah. You still need that physical touch to get them the help that they need, because interaction face-to-face is the only way you can figure it out.
Well, I mean, and kind of looping in DCF to that as well. You know, yeah. We saw, I think, some of the fallouts when you talk about a video conference versus having physical eyes.
Correct.
And being able to, like, physically see someone right in front of you. So I think when we're dealing with mental health, it's not always the answer. It might be something that we can utilize and that might be available if needed, but it shouldn't be the first option when it comes to mental health. And that's something that we were hearing, but it's the hard part of, and it was, I think it was across the board. It was not just one specific area, is retention,
mm-hmm.
on having qualified people and keeping jobs and keeping qualified good people in positions that are so desperately needed. And it wasn't just healthcare, it wasn't just education, it wasn't just law enforcement, it wasn't just
right.
public safety. It was across the board. And it's almost like, where the heck did everybody go?
And is it the system that's causing that issue for a pay issue, or?
Well, I don't necessarily think, from our understanding, I don't think it was a pay issue. I think it's just the burnout. When you think of the yep. COVID burnout, it's a legitimate thing, and that's what we were hearing throughout all the testimonies. It was a burnout in education. It was a burnout in healthcare. It was a burnout in public safety. It was just so demanding of so many people that didn't just get to turn their, you know, lights off and say, okay, I'm taking a COVID vacation. They still had to, whether they went to physically to work or had to work remote, they still had to show up for, you know, the people and their jobs that they were, you know, entrusted to do. So I think, especially around healthcare and mental mm-hmm. health, we heard it's the burnout. It's the you know, that 2 year almost window of they can't take it. And when you talk about mental health, not only is mental health becoming more forefront, it's COVID, I think, related as well, right? Mm-hmm. So we're dealing with a twofold here. So we're dealing with the pandemic, a shutdown, isolation, to now being back to, quote, what we remember as, like, real life before a pandemic. Mm. And I think having those two kind of right back to back, mental health is just beyond, I think, what anyone expected.
Yeah, I agree. But you're right. Across the board, everyone's our attorneys. I mean, you name it, everyone's right. looking for help.
Yep.
And I think the last session I was in the Future Workforce Commission with Rep Cutler.
Right.
And we found that, you know, across the Commonwealth. And as someone had mentioned too, you know, you have people called, well, they're collecting, they're sitting on their couch collecting, and that's really not the case. Peter, no. You know, you have trouble finding help as well.
And I don't know how they're compensating themselves being home, because we see it on our end with the unemployment. So people that we had laid off,
mm-hmm.
they collected, and now they're off the roll.
Mm.
They're not collecting at all.
And they're still not back to work.
But is it a part of it, if you look on Glassdoor, if you look at Monster, you look at any mm-hmm. of the sites, that if you're seeking employees or if you're seeking employment, that there is a big jump in the work-at-home type platforms that folks prefer? I'm sorry. I go to the supermarket. I see more and more people walking around in sweatpants and pajamas than I see anybody dressing regularly.
Hey, don't judge me.
No. But a lot, you know, a lot of it's well, that, the comfort of home.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the younger generation too. You know, I think there's, and it's not knocking the younger generation. It's what they're used to.
Yeah.
You know, you figure the pandemic was supposed to be a 2 week shutdown and turned into a 2 year shutdown.
Yeah.
So that younger workforce that's used to working from home, that's what they're used to. That's what they're comfortable doing.
And that's what they're demanding.
Right. And so it's knowing that companies have been able to do it for 2 years and sitting here trying to justify why they should continue that same path. So it's, you know, unfortunately for teachers, you can't work from home. Public safety, you can't work from home. Mental health, you can't work from home. Hospitals, you cannot work from home. You have to physically go there. So I think that they're competing with these businesses that are able to do this work from home mentality. I mean, so many people are probably working for out-of-state companies from the comforts of their own home.
Yeah, if you are just tuning in, we are speaking with, it's the State House Report, State Representatives Kathy Lenatra and Allison Sullivan Almeida. And talking a little bit about their time on the ways and means, traveling around the state, hearings, some of what the input that they have received from citizens around the Commonwealth, our hearing's done, are we now time for to get into the meat and potatoes and do the House's version of the budget?
Our House debate is going on next week. I'm excited.
Are you really? Why, what excites you?
Well, it's just it's the uniting of all of our reps, right? We're with each other for at least 3 days from sunup to sundown.
It's a dogfight.
But it is and it isn't. You know, we have a great chair on Ways and Means. And Chairman Michalowicz does a great job at having those in-person meetings before the budget debate goes forward, knowing what individual reps, what their priorities are and what their needs are for their district and trying to fulfill said needs, right? And you have to remember, there's 160 of us. I can only imagine being a parent to 160 kids, okay? Because that's what, or 159 kids, you know, I feel like, because that's probably what it is. You got a bunch of reps asking, you know, for really important things, you know, whether it be a statewide issue or a local issue, it's very important. And I think it'll be interesting having, you know, this will be our second year, I think, since COVID that we're back into, you know, being squished into a room and asking and begging and pleading for our money. And, you know, it's always fun to watch the new reps do what they
do.
And it's interesting because I feel like, you know, Kathy and I, we were lucky. We were the last class that I think had a normal session pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. And to see the new reps come in, you know, they have this whole speech prepared. And it's like, listen, you got 30 seconds to say this is what you want, this is what you need, and ask for it. So it'll be good. And then, you see people that you haven't seen in a while, and you're able to connect and work in, you know.
It's where relationships are developed. It really is. It's a great experience when you say it's a full week, and you're there from sunup sometimes till midnight, you know, three nights, four nights, and there is some debate on the floor. I love debate. It's one of my favorite things about being in the House, but you come to consensus so many times, which is fantastic.
So if I can ask you, and that is the budget, the structure of the budget, is there a difference between, you know, the last administration, Baker administration, under the current administration, under Healey? Is there a different structure? Are you seeing monies shifted around? Have you had a chance to look at it and have discussions, or is that what next week is all about?
So I think, you know, once, you know, we start debating kind of where our money's going, I guess to answer your question, yes and no. There's definitely some funding that the current administration put more funding into that the Baker administration maybe did not, or vice versa. We get those emails all the time that, you know, under Baker's administration, it was funded at X million dollars, and under, you know, the Healey administration, it's funded, you know, half that, or, you know, not nearly as much, and we're asking to fully fund it to what the Baker administration was under. So there, if that's what your question was, and I think that's what your question was, there's definitely some points. Off the top of my head, I don't know, nothing's really coming to mind that's like shouting at me. Maybe for you, Kathy, something comes to mind?
And H1, so in Healey's, her budget, you know, there's a lot of in housing, like her priority is housing. Right. And I think there's more money in housing. There's some tax breaks in there that Governor Baker was going to do as well. It just never went through last time. So there's some tax breaks in there, the estate tax. There's a lot of great things in this budget.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I feel as though with this current administration, housing, transportation, specifically the MBTA, and maybe trying to better educate our older population, 25 plus.
Yeah, I think that's
with the college initiative.
Yes. Yeah, with the the local
community colleges.
Yep.
Any bit of a boost to the Student Opportunity Act as well?
Be fully funded. Yep. Fully funded through this. Student, $60. Regional transportation, $60 per pupil.
Yep.
Yeah. There's a lot of good things in this budget, so I'm looking forward to next week as well.
So while we have you here for a couple of more moments, any legislative updates, anything from the district, anything fun you want to share in regards to what's going on, whether it's the 12th Plymouth or the 7th Plymouth districts?
Well, we have, in all our districts, we have our town meetings coming up.
Oh, Abington already had
theirs. Oh, you did. Yes. So we have Kingston's in May. Plymouth just had theirs as well, so Plymouth had their town meeting.
Elections.
Pembroke's coming up. Town elections everywhere.
Yeah,
so we might have whole new regimes in our communities, in our district.
Wow.
You never know.
Anything, if folks want to find out more as to constituent services, they need to reach out to you.
Yep, absolutely. On my Facebook page, it's State Rep Kathy Lenatra, or my website is kathylenatra.com. You can always call us at the State House. We are listed. We have moved our offices. So I have a new phone number, which I actually don't know yet, but you can always mass.gov, look us up. Allison's looking it up right now. But mass.gov, you can look us up for our office phone numbers and always reach us there.
So I'm trying to find Kathy's number so we have it. We'll see if we can get Kathy's number. I haven't seen Kathy's new room, nor has she seen my new office. So that'll be a fun thing to do.
So you have new offices
we
now?
Do, and we used to share. We were in the same suite. So we would yell at each other all the time.
Yeah, and the funny thing is she was giving me a hard time about me moving before her, and then she ended up leaving that suite too. So, you know, I said to her, we're both moving on up, you know?
I didn't want to leave.
I did love our suite.
I loved
it. It was nice. But I was in a hot box.
You were.
So where are you located now, and who are some of
your... I'm in 146, which is post-audit. It's a lovely, lovely office. It's just different. I mean, I spent the two sessions where I was in healthcare finance, and we had Dodie and Rita
and
Denise, mm-hmm. who are receptionists, who were like den mothers, basically. They mm-hmm. were wonderful.
They still come visit, though.
They do, well. Yeah, yeah. They're wonderful.
They love Catherine. I have to give a shout out to my aide, Catherine, because she is, and she's so good that she actually just texted me your number.
Catherine.
Yes.
Catherine.
She is so good, and she may be listening. I don't know. She's dealing with some family stuff right now, but
Gold
your
star,
number
Catherine.
Is 617-722-2575 is your new number.
Oh, that's an easy one to remember.
Yes.
Thank you.
Now, do you have a new number?
My new number is 722-2488.
And she was sure to put that in the same
too.
Text, huh?
Yes.
That's a good aid right there.
That is a good aid.
Yes.
It's a good aid right
and
there.
And I'm on the fifth floor now, so we have a new office as well, and I have a window, thank God, because air is very important in pregnancy.
I would say early on, there was one of the times you moved out of the bullpen, and you weren't anywhere near a window.
I was into the smallest cubicle in the State House. I think I had a bigger cubicle when I worked for A&F.
Wow.
So, and I shared my cubicle with my former aide, Curtis. So it wasn't just me in that cubicle. Do you remember from 39?
Yep. I do.
So,
yes.
And then Patrick,
tight quarters.
And Patrick Kearney, I think, had the second smallest cubicle. So, you know, we made it work. And at the end of the day, like I said, when I was a new rep and even when, you know, now being in my third term, you know, the work is done in the district. So
right. They
can always tell me where to sit. They can never tell me when to stand. So it's important that we continue to...
That's a T-shirt right there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a marquee term.
That's a T-shirt.
Senator Markey. Let's give credit. My dad's the one that would always kind of... say stuff like that to me. But we talk about the 10-year anniversary. I'll never forget, 10 years ago, my dad was running for U.S. Senate. And we were actually supposed to have a fundraiser right near the finish line of the Boston Marathon.
Oh, my gosh.
And my mom was out of town, and I was getting ready to leave Abington to head into the city to meet my father, and I got a phone call from my cousin. And I'll never forget, he goes, where are you? And I said, I'm walking out of the house. And he goes, don't leave. And I'm thinking to myself, what happened? You know, my mom was away with his mother. And I turned on the news, and it reminded me, and it's probably reminded all of you guys, of 9/11.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, watching on the screen something so horrific and so sad, it was scary. And mm-hmm. I'll never forget that. And the inability to get a hold of my family at that point because they, you know, cut cell phone reception, everything else. I knew people that were running the marathon, that were on the finish line and not knowing if they were okay. And then on top of it, my sister was deployed at that same exact time. So she was overseas seeing this happen and play out. And she knew our plan was to be at the finish line and be in that area around that time. So she was... definitely comforted by some of her National Guards men and women who actually, there was a Massachusetts troop that was stationed there as well with her. She was living in Florida at the time. So we were just talking about this, and it's sad, but we look how far, you know, Boston has come, and we're Boston strong. And, you know, I'll never forget David Ortiz making that speech at the Red Sox game, and it's still true today. And you see it because we're resilient and we bounce back, and 10 years later, and we're still doing it. And these terrorists can't hold us down.
State Representative Allison Sullivan Almeida, Catherine, Is it Catherine?
Kathleen.
Kathleen.
It's because of Catherine. It's because of my age. We were talking about Catherine.
Kathy Lenatra, State House Report. We're going to step aside. When we come back, more Monday Night Talk.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. People ask me, is there anything they can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
Is there anything I can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
See? There is. Those big gravel trucks, when they're being loaded, rocks get stuck in the framework of the bed. Truck hits a bump, rock hits your windshield. It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
It's Ram Truck Month right now at Quirk Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram on Route 139 in Marshfield. Quirk Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram is one of the largest dealerships of its kind in New England, featuring an incredible inventory of brand new Ram trucks, great customer service, and Quirk's Chrysler Certified Service Department. Quirk Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram is accessible from all across the South Shore, just off Route 3 at the new exit 27. Quirk works to save you money. Quirk works for you. Visit QuirkChryslerDodgeJeepRam.com.
Saturdays following the 12 o'clock news, join Arthur Boyle and Zach Clapp on The Boiling Point as they try to make sense out of what goes on around us. Sponsored in part by Pembroke Collision and other fine folks in the community. Set your dial to 95.9 FM WATD for The Boiling Point. See you on Saturday.
The Boiling Point with Arthur Boyle and Zach Clapp. Saturdays, 12:15 to 1 on 95.9 WATD.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We return for more Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. And we're going to talk a little bit about businesses, Pembroke Chamber.
Yes.
I actually want to give a little bit of a plug to the barbershop in Whitman and shop with...
It's because he's getting all these compliments.
Does look pretty good.
Look good.
Most importantly, the missus liked it. Yeah.
That's the most important thing.
The ladies at Town Hall, they were like, Kevin, did you just get your hair cut?
Amy Barrett.
Within the last, 30 minutes?
That's because Amy Barrett, I had a meeting with her. We were over at the Abington Senior Center. It's going to be an event that's going to be taking place this Saturday. And I had stopped by the senior center just to look at the space, and I saw her 20 minutes after I had been refreshed. She goes, wait a minute. Did you have a haircut when I saw you last? I go, no. I just had it done. But you had asked me, Kathy had asked me a question on the parking lot. And so this is a barber, and I made the mistake of telling her that I used to go to a couple of the businesses up the street. And I kind of was told that there's a difference between a barber and a hairdresser.
Hair salon? Yeah.
And a hair salon. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, all right, well, whatever makes me look best, I go to whenever I have time. And one of the individuals who I work with was the one who told me to stop by and had a chance to learn and it was a different experience. So thumbs up to Debbie at the barbershop in Whitman, right near the commuter rail.
Debbie, you did a fantastic job.
You did a great job, Debbie.
Yeah. I'll even say it looks good.
My dad's gone to the same barber, pretty much his whole life.
Really?
Yep, in Randolph.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I've changed mine a few times, so.
That's commitment.
That is commitment. So, Peter.
Yes.
How are you, my friend?
Great, thank you.
You are currently the president of the Pembroke Chamber of Commerce.
Yes,
How are things with the Chamber these days?
Actually, it's excellent. I was just talking to State Rep Lenatra about it earlier, and the revitalization of the Pembroke Chamber, and thanks to Josh Cutler and you helping us support it. During COVID, it kind of fell off a little bit. Like everybody else, the networking stopped, and businesses hunkered down, and we're a total volunteer board, so we had had to worry about our businesses first. And the past 5 months, we've been really kicking hard and getting it revitalized, and it's been good.
Did you see a downturn in membership?
Yeah, oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we all across the board. I mean, where I was on the board for the Plymouth Chamber, I connected with Amy Naples. We talk about it a lot, and is that peanut butter or jelly?
I just spilled some food on me.
That's okay. It's good. So it was across the board, but you know, the past summer, as people get more comfortable getting out and doing the networking stuff, the face-to-face, they want to be involved. And the best thing about Pembroke now is that we got the rec center started in the
yes.
Pembroke Center. So there's been a rejuvenation of, you know, downtown Pembroke and revitalization of economic development that we haven't seen before because of that. And so the businesses want to get more involved, so we've been helping them.
Well, we got another big project that's up before a big vote on May 9th.
Yeah.
The public safety building. Now, the town has already voted to spend money for a community center.
Yes.
Is the town going to be willing to spend more money for...
See, that's the key. And that's where the people of Pembroke have to look at the future of what Pembroke wants to be, what they want Pembroke to be. And we have surrounding towns that have modernized and built new public safety buildings, new DPWs, new Council on Aging, mm-hmm. And you have your residents going to other places and not being involved in your own town, there's an issue. So they realized that with the rec center, and they voted that in. And I think they're starting to realize that with the public safety issue, because that Pembroke covers a lot of area. And the stations are antiquated, so is the police and fire. I mean, the police department. They're outgrowing that force. So they purchased that corner piece of property across from Tiny's Corner, you know, about five, I think it was 8 years ago now. And it's a perfect spot. And it's an opportunity to get Pembroke back on the map. And people want to live in that town. And the only way we're going to entice people to move in is to show that we care about it. And that's one of the processes to get it done.
Now, there is, I believe, 2 weeks from tomorrow.
Right.
There's going to be a forum about that.
Yeah.
Are you hearing a lot of buzz that it's going to be highly attended and that
yes.
folks going to be there with their questions?
Yes. Both chiefs asked me if I could, well, actually, Bill Chenard asked me if I could host it at my business. Sharon McNamara did it at her spot, did it at the library a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago. So yeah, we're expecting. We did the same similar open house for the rec center when Andrew Sullivan presented it the first time, and it's my shop will be open from 5:30 to 7. They'll do a presentation, and we hope people will come and watch.
You have a question, Kathy?
So what's really fascinating to me, which I'm hearing, these public safety buildings encompasses the fire and the police.
Correct.
You know, it's, with everything going on, they're starting to train together too. There's like ASHA trainings and different trainings. So I think it's really beneficial to a town to have them working together.
Definitely. I mean, and what the perfect example is now is we have two young chiefs.
Mm-hmm. You too.
That, you know, nothing against Rick or, you know, Mike when they were in the past, but we have moved on to a newer regime.
Right.
And these two are connected. And they understand the process, and they understand that the only way to get things done is to collaborate.
Mm-hmm.
And Governor Baker was big on that when
yes.
we're trying to do anything in the state house, is find somebody that's similar in the process and collaborate, and you probably get financing. And that's where the key. And Bill Chenard has been a leader of that, and he understands the process, and that's where this has to go forward. And it's not just the public safety building. They're talking about modernizing two other stations. So we'll have a satellite station over on Monroe Street. And it's a good thing.
It's interesting that you have multiple communities on the South Shore that are looking to build complexes like this. Brockton is doing a general complex. They're going to replace their police station, mm-hmm. the central fire station. I believe their emergency management agency is going to be there, as well as their IT will be a part of that campus. Abington mm-hmm. going to be later on this year looking to move their main fire station over near the DPW and the police station.
Right, right.
Another great idea.
Right.
And it seems like a lot of communities are doing this and need to replace their public safety buildings.
Right.
And
I think it's also smart, though, when you think of it, right? Yeah. So, like, you know, unfortunately, Abington has seen their fair share of tragedies and other communities as well, like Duxbury. And you think about fire, right? And fire works as a group. They work as a unit. Mm-hmm. They're always together. So when they go to a tragedy, they get to get back to the station, debrief, have some dialogue, you know, kind of really pinpoint the areas that might need to be discussed and those certain people that might need more attention. Where in these local communities, police officers get back into a single unit car mm-hmm. and they patrol these smaller towns by themselves, and maybe right after a tragedy have to go right back into it because of short staffing. So, you know, you think of having this, you know, a joint kind of public safety building. I think there's not just benefits to the town, but also benefits to the public safety officials that work within the towns.
Exactly.
Again, Peter Brown, our guest for this segment. What are they talking? What's the tag, price tag?
Oh,
on this? Or, I mean, is that one of the concerns? Or are you hearing from residents what their concerns are in regards to this project?
So, yeah, there's concerns, and the concerns are is the tax issue and that, you know, that process of it. But they have to look at it as an investment. And it's an enticement for businesses and residents to move into town.
Right.
Especially because when you go looking at a town, the first thing they look at is the schools and
the safety
and amenities.
Yeah.
And as Pembroke starts to grow and you see the surrounding towns, you know, pushing economic development, Pembroke has to follow suit. And Bill Chouinard has been doing an amazing job, but still you have, you know, I've been in town, you know, I'm the second generation. You have third and fourth generation people. And there are people that say no. We have a population also that's over, you know, a lot of people over 65.
Mm.
So that's a big stipend. But I remember the biggest thing my dad used to talk about, because my dad's house was on the corner of 14 and 53. And he'd sit in his recliner, and he'd count the number of times the ambulance would go by.
Mm.
And every time that he had to, you know, when he was sick and go on the ambulance ride, he called it, the bus is coming to pick me up. And he'd talk to the people that would pick him up and tell them how many times he saw that ambulance go by the house. And that end of town services a huge area of town. And that with that public safety building in the corner, well, the response time would be much better.
Yeah, it would be much quicker.
Much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So, but as far as the business aspect of it, the chamber aspect of it, we're a community-driven chamber. So it's not more or less, it's not just economic development, but it's how to get the businesses involved in the community with, you know, youth sports, education, internships, scholarships, the whole nine yards, and education. And like I was telling, you know, Kathy, we were talking about earlier, the biggest player that we have right now in our chamber is Aiden Blake. He's our intern from the Path, you know, the Pathfinders. Pathfinders, Mary Ellen Gates set up for the interns, and he is amazing.
Mm. Yes,
this kid is just—he's written emails to everybody. I follow the email trails, and they're all responding to him. They all want to be part of the chamber, you know, Chamber of Commerce. He's just selling them like you would not believe.
And you're getting him involved, you know, at a young age.
Oh yeah,
right.
Yeah,
opening him up to people that have businesses, giving him opportunities to meet these local business owners. I think it's a win-win situation all the whole way around.
Well, talk about the leadership that Mary Ellen has done. Mary Ellen Gates has done at the Pembroke High School.
Yes.
And that presentation we did in November
mm-hmm.
Has been, you know, she's placed, I think, 15 kids throughout the community.
That's fantastic.
To work with businesses as interns. So it's awesome.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I want to say what I think is awesome, Peter, is the different hats that you wear. You're not only just a business owner, but we get a chance to speak at least about one particular thing. I would only wonder how many different hats you wear, different organizations that you represent. You are a true champion of the community.
Yeah. Well, my dad left me at a spot that I can't mess up. And
Peter is everywhere. So. Peter is everywhere. He makes me feel like a slacker.
But you ever seen
Far from it.
Yeah.
I'm going to say you are far from it, so I can only imagine how busy.
So when the little one's born, I'll take out, you know, my dad's car, the 37.
Yes.
So when she first ran for state rep, We drove around in Pembroke with the, and her in the back of the 37. Yeah. And it's there's no top. So I get up like 35, 40 miles an hour, and the hair's like, oh, like so when the little ones, well, we'll have to take a ride.
Definitely.
Yeah. We'll go slower.
Yeah, exactly.
Peter,
folks, if this child's anything like me and its dad, go fast, take chances.
That's right.
Peter, folks want to find out more about what's going on with the Pembroke Chamber of Commerce, or maybe they might want to join.
They want to join, it's pembrokechamber.org, or if they can call me at the shop, I'll walk them through it. It's really easy to do. We have a great admin. Diane Cooter does all our admin work. Aiden Blake's our intern. Vicki Lasanis just became our treasurer. She's at Bluestone Bank. In fact, that's our next after hours is, I should talk about that, because... Our next after hours is May 16th at Bluestone Bank in Pembroke Center. So any businesses that want to show up and meet the new vice president of Bluestone Bank, she's there. And she's our treasurer, and she does a great job.
There he is, Peter Brown. He'll stick around and share the co-hosting duties.
Yeah, because it's free water. So this
Free water.
Yeah. Plenty of free water, yeah. So courtesy of Monday Night Talk.
Thank you.
That's it, hour number one in the books. Hour number two ahead, Casey Sherman on deck. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk. We'll be right back.
WATV-FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD. Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
We are back. Hour number two here, Monday Night to Talk. Later this hour, we're going to speak with the car doctor, John Paul. Looking for a used car? Don't get taken. That's coming up 7:30. But right now, we speak with New York Times bestselling author, Casey Sherman, a recurring guest. Both he and his co-writer of many books, Dave Wedge, our regulars on this radio program here, that we're actually talking tonight, 10-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing. Let's not forget that they wrote a book,
yep.
Boston Strong. They were trying a new movie bought by Mark Wahlberg or his company.
Yep, yeah. Boston Strong was adapted into Patriot's Day in 2016.
Yep.
And, you know, we're all, I think, having our own memories resurrected 10 years later. And it's interesting to see we spent, you know, a year with well over, you know, maybe 50 survivors of the Boston Marathon bombings and tried to tell their stories as best as we could. You couldn't tell all of the stories because you could never do that justice.
Sure.
And there are so many ripple effects that the bombing, you know, really created, you know, as a community and as a commonwealth here. And I will say that, you know, we always are pretty in tune with the survivors that we still maintain strong friendships with. You know, this year has been a little different. Normally, you know, they can get through the anniversary and they, you know, obviously feel some sorrow and some sadness and some physical and mental aches and pains. This year has been different. They, you know, the people we've talked to have been very reticent to, you know, take part in some of the observances, public observances. You know, for some reason the 10 years has hit them hard, and I get it. You know, they have the, you know, Boston Marathon bombing is every day to them. You know, it's every year for us, or every, you know, 5 months if we see somebody or something that reminds us of that day in 2013, but it's every day for them.
Life-changing. That life, day was life-changing.
Yeah, that day was life-changing for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I mean, in this room here, you know, hopefully none of you were directly impacted by the bombings, but everybody's life changed. Mm. You know, and 1% of the trauma that we felt, you know, watching it all unfold. You can just imagine, you know, the 99% of trauma that they feel every day. But what I also love about it is so many phoenixes have risen from the ashes of Boylston Street and the campus of MIT. There's been so much good that has been created of you know, excuse me, from so much badness and sadness that's what I'm hanging on to 10 years later.
You and Dave actually just a little less than a week ago, it was published in the Boston Magazine an article about the bombing, and you had a chance to speak with some individuals whose family members were involved in the bombing. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, we decided to revisit some of the people that we wrote about in Boston Strong, and we narrowed that field down to about four or five people, just to touch base with them and see what their lives were like and how the bombing had really changed them. And, you know, I mean, those conversations really impacted me. You know, one woman that I interviewed, her name was Tracy Monroe. Now, Tracy, I interviewed 10 years ago because she was a first responder at Forum, which is where the second bomb went off, and she comforted 7-year-old Jane Richard before Jane was brought into the ambulance and then taken to Children's Hospital. And she was a young mom at the time and realized that, you know, Jane's family had, you know, suffered traumatic injuries on the scene, and Jane needed somebody there to comfort her because her mother, Denise, was critically injured at the time. So that's what Tracy did. And now, 10 years later, Tracy still kind of follows Jane's, you know, upbringing and is so proud of the young woman that Jane Richard is now. She writes Jane letters that really? She never sends to Jane.
Oh.
It's just, it's cathartic mm-hmm. for her, and it's therapy for her. So, you know, she's living in Salt Lake City now, and she's got a stack of letters that she's never mailed. But again, you know, she observes Jane from afar and, as I said, is very proud of the young woman that she is. Also interviewed Ed DeVoe. Ed DeVoe is the police chief in Watertown, you know, where all, you know, that band of brothers, if you will, the Watertown Police Department confronted Tamerlan and Joe Karsanayev on Laurel Street just a couple days after the bombings. And this was the first time and only time that engaged in a firefight with police, suspects were literally hurling pipe bombs at them. And Ed reflected on it and said, you know, 9 times out of 10, you know, that scene is a bloodbath and we lose a lot of officers. It's amazing that they didn't lose, you know, besides what unfortunately befell Sean Collier hours before, they did not lose any officers on Laurel Street. And he said, you know, for one night in the history of the world, the Watertown Police Department was the greatest police department on earth.
Cool. Anything new? I don't want to be the one who's
just,
kind of,
you know, thinking back of that, at the Watertown Police, you know, I think I've mentioned before, my husband's a police officer, and he was a detective in the gang unit during 9/11. So he was there during 9/11, and at the bombings, he was here in Massachusetts. And when he watched it, that's what came back to him was 9/11. So it's, you know, someone that's suffered a traumatic event or has been through a traumatic event, and then to have another one, you know, he came from New York City and moved to Boston and thought Boston was, you know, really safe and wonderful, and he still does, but it brings back that traumatic event.
It does, and there are a lot of people that have that connection to 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Boston police officer Javier Pagan, who was captured in that iconic photo of three police officers standing over that runner fallen to the ground on Boylston Street. It became the cover of our book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Javier's husband, you know, was on duty in New York City on 9/11. He retired
mm-hmm.
shortly thereafter because of all the PTSD that he was experiencing, and he moved up to Boston with his husband, and, you know, several years later, this is what happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's almost like you can't outrun it. You know, you have to deal with it head on when it happens, and then also, you know, deal with all the repercussions of an event like that. And, you know, when Boston Strong, Kevin, what I wanted to do, and my co-author Dave Wedge, is we didn't really want to focus or especially glorify the bombers. We had to write about them to provide connective tissue and context to what was happening, but we wrote about the survivors and the first responders. We were never going to call our book Boston Strong because, you know, it was a slogan, it was a T-shirt. But every time we would sit down with a family Let it be, you know, the Collier family in Wilmington, Massachusetts, where we sat around a table with Sean's brothers and sisters and mom and dad for almost an entire day and heard so many amazing stories about this young man that they didn't even know about. And Dave and I would walk out of these interviews weeping, mm-hmm. you know, hugging them, hugging each other, and we'd sit in a car for about 20 minutes just, you know, decompressing. And the one word we kept on coming back to was strength. Strength. These people are so damn strong. And yeah, Boston Strong was a slogan, but we're going to show you what it really means, and that's what I hope we did.
When you look back initially on that day, your memory of the reporting and what was happening, and all the people that you have talked about, talk to me about how that is from what you remember to what you have experienced through the eyes of either victims or family members of victims.
Sure. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, the day the bombs go off, I was in Boston. I wasn't actually physically at the finish line. Did try to get down there because I was concerned about some friends that were down there, but I was not even allowed anywhere near there. So monitored it like a lot of people did over the next few days. My co-author Dave Wedge was inside Watertown reporting for the Boston Herald at the time. And when they captured Dzhokhar Tsarnaev and ended up killing Tamerlan Tsarnaev, I got a call from the screenwriters of my first film, The Finest Hours. And they're watching it from L.A. And the first words that they ask me is, "You're writing a book about this, right?" And I said, "Wait, yet, you know, guys, this is all unfolding in real time. I usually like some historical perspective, you know, to really dig into a story like this. And it might be too soon." And, you know, their response was, "Casey, you know, it's never too soon to talk about stories of real heroism, much like we did with The Finest Hours." So they said, "You write the book and we'll make the film." And that's what we did. And over the course of the year that we wrote the book, we also had an amazing experience with 100 survivors of the Boston Marathon bombings, because we were invited on a healing cruise in France down the Rhone River with 100 survivors that were, you know, basically put on a desert island by a local travel company. I'll give them a shout out, Vantage Deluxe World Travel out of Boston. They paid for it all. Over $1 million, the survivors had to pay nothing. The guests had to pay nothing, not even their airfare. So we were able to watch as flies on the wall of this healing process really take place, because these survivors never really got together with each other, only to, you know, be commemorated or honored at events. Here they could spend 11 days, cry, you know, drink, laugh, hug, and we get to witness it, and it was absolutely beautiful. And the last real memory of that, in, you know, that time for me, was covering the Dzhokhar trial. You know, I was there just about every day, and I was there the day that they imposed the death sentence on Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, because, you know, they had already found him guilty day one of the trial. His defense attorney said, "Did he do it?" "Yeah, because he's captured on every surveillance camera in the city of Boston, Cambridge, Watertown, you name it. But we're gonna try to convince you that he was radicalized by his brother." To an extent, that's true. But one of the videotapes that was shown was outside Forum Restaurant, where Dzhokhar Tsarnaev has 9 minutes to walk behind the crowd, 9 minutes to leave and not detonate a bomb. And he planted that backpack right behind Martin Richard, because he wanted to destroy the epitome of an American family. So come full circle, the day that the jury is really weighing this man's life or death, the prosecutor brings in a box to the jury room, or to the courtroom, I should say. And the medical examiner has to identify what's in the box. And he does. And he pulls out the clothing that Martin Richard was wearing when he was killed. You can hear the shrapnel, you know, rattling around in the box. A pair of pants that you didn't even know what it was. Those are Martin Richard's pants. And everybody just gasped. I think the jury made their decision right there. Now, regardless of what you feel about the death penalty, and people have their individual feelings, and I get that. And nobody cheered. Nobody high-fived. Nobody said, "Yeah, justice has been served." Everybody felt another loss. Like, you know, this young man put us there. You know, the jury had to deliver this, you know, verdict.
Forced their hand.
Yep. And so those are the memories 10 years later that I still wrestle with.
Just worth noting some numbers and information here. Three people killed directly as a result of the bombing. Two others, Sean Collier,
yep,
and Dennis Simmons. Simmons, who was a part of the Watertown shootout.
That's correct. And you know, DJ Simmons passed a year later, and he doesn't get the same reverence or recognition that the other, you know, victims do. He is now. You know, I will say 10 years later, you do see him, you know, represented when they call out the victims' names. And I've spoken to DJ's mom, you know, many times, and she was very angry, you know, that there wasn't the same outpouring of support and love for him. Granted, he died a year later. However, you know, now I think that I hope that she's finding some, you know, healing by the fact that he's being brought into the fold.
They approximate about 281 civilians were treated at some 27 local hospitals. It's kind of interesting as to those individuals still living their lives knowing that they were part of this moment that took place during an event that's supposed to be fun and people use as milestones. Throw in a name, Chris Diorio, who we had in here last week, who's doing a fundraiser to help Mass General Hospital and the pediatric cancer care. I mean, that's what stuff like this is about, is you know, to raise money and help others. Or, yeah, you want to see folks who set records and go on to the Olympics. Sure, that's great. But there are other onion, you know, layers to the onion when it comes to an event like this. For it to have such a memory, to have an event like this happen. What have we learned since this day? I'm going to go around the room. We'll start with you, Casey.
Sure. You know, what I will say is Boston Marathon, it's a world-class marathon. It's the most famous marathon in the world, but it's still our marathon. To your point, Kevin, you know, people kind of forget the elite runners and who wins and who loses. That's all great, and the fanfare is amazing, but it's the moms and dads who run the marathon for charity or running just to test themselves. You know, as you mentioned, everybody kind of running for a cause, and I think that has been amplified since the bombing, and it's taken so you know, personally now. So what have we learned? I will say, if that bombing happened in any other city in the United States, including New York City, the death toll would have been in the hundreds. But the fact that you had seven Trauma One hospitals within almost walking distance of the marathon bombings, and they had all been trained because of 9/11. They had all been retrained for, you know, battlefield type triage. So when the bombings happened, you know, not one survivor that made it to the hospital perished. Unbelievable.
Kathy?
Well, that was a tough question. I was hoping we would go to Peter next.
Peter. Peter, what do you feel that what have we learned at this 10-year anniversary of this event? What do you, just personally, what do you think?
I feel secure to see what happened and the strength of the people that came out that day to take care of the injured and what happened 2 days later and how this basically the state shut down until they caught him.
That's right.
Right.
So
it's crazy.
Right. Yep. It was, you know, again, I'm trying to separate 9/11 there, but what it did, it brought people together, mm-hmm. you know, like a sense of community. Mm-hmm. And I think the marathon has always been a community. I was a volunteer for 20 years straight, and that was a year that I wasn't volunteering at the finish line, thankfully. But it brought people together, and I have lots of friends that run, and they still run. Like, for them to go back the next year to run, mm-hmm. I think was, again, what you mentioned is strength, and that's Boston Strong. They're not going to put us down. We're going to come back. You can't stop us. So that's how I look at Boston, the city. That's how I look at the whole Commonwealth. And when the chips are down and a tragedy happens, we do have a sense of community.
We got a few more minutes left here with Casey Sherman, New York Times bestselling author, producer extraordinaire. Just want to kind of tick down a few things
sure,
that you got happening here.
Sure, thank you.
I think recently you did a Hamptons whodunit. You were part of a, I think you were the moderator for
a
panel.
Yeah, I was the true crime chair for an inaugural crime and mystery book festival in the Hamptons in New York. First time that I'd been there. And I'm a Cape Cod kid. I didn't have to go to the Hamptons, and I couldn't afford it. So, you know, here's a hardscrabble kid from the mean streets of Hyannis hobnobbing with the Hampton elite. I don't know if I fit in. But we had a good time, and we brought a lot of authors from all over the country and really all over the world to this really unique experience. And I was amazed at how many people from across the world came for this inaugural event. So we're looking to, you know, have year two next year and make it into an even bigger event.
Let's talk Hunting Whitey. Now, this is a sold-out event. But you got to be thrilled. This is going to be at the Wilbur Theater on May 1st.
Yeah, it's May 16th, but still sold out.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I hit the wrong
date. You almost scared me because I need a little more prep
May 1st
time.
Is coming around the corner.
Right, right. Well, you know, we're very excited to bring adapt our best-selling book, Hunting Whitey, onto the stage at the Wilbur Theater. And our show stars actor Neil McDonough, who was born in Dorchester, raised on Cape Cod. He's had a career in Hollywood going back 30 years, all the way back to the Band of Brothers, as
Love
we were talking
Band
about off air. And, you know, we've been friends. I went to high school with him. So we've been friends for about 35
Super
years.
Super cool.
And we always talked about the Whitey Bulger case, and he said, Casey, that's the role that I was born to play. And when I gave him this opportunity to be Whitey Bulger in front of a Boston audience, he jumped at it. And obviously, we want to make sure that we can expand the Whitey Bulger universe, create a limited series, and figure out what else we can do with it. But Neil's going to be our guy.
You got to be excited. Knowing that you, this is the second such, it's going to be similar to what you did previously, correct?
A little similar to what we did previously, correct. So you'll have, you know, Dave Wedge and I as the omnipotent narrators on stage, providing the connective tissue, but we're also deconstructing the Whitey Bulger myth.
Right.
That's what I love about it. We're not glorifying this gangster from South Boston. We're tearing him down through the people that found him, caught him, and eventually killed him.
Helltown News. I know this is correct because we had talked about it during the break. A paperback edition to Helltown 2 weeks from tomorrow, May 2nd.
2 weeks from tomorrow, yep, May 2nd.
And being spun into a series.
Yeah, we're really excited about this. So we're going to be adapting my book Helltown, which is about a serial murder case on Cape Cod, into a limited series for Amazon Studios. And, you know, we've chatted about this off air, but when I was writing the book, I had already sold the television rights to Robert Downey Jr.'s production company called Team Downey. So I'm writing the pages and sending them to my partners in LA, and we're building a team over the past couple of years. And my, you know, purview into this brutal story about a serial murder case in 1969 are two iconic authors, Kurt Vonnegut and Norman Mailer, who become darkly obsessed with this case. So Oscar Isaac, an Oscar-nominated and Emmy Award-winning actor, is going to be playing Kurt Vonnegut as really kind of our lead actor. And then we were, talk about an embarrassment of riches, our director is Edward Berger, and he just picked up four Oscars for directing All Quiet on the Western Front for Netflix.
Fantastic.
So it's an elevated project. We're working on the pilot as we speak, because there's going to be a writer's strike in Hollywood, and we want to bank as much material as we can. So when that strike is resolved, knock on wood, hopefully very soon, we can just hit the ground running again.
Either one of you, I'm like hogging the microphone here.
Anything that you want to touch upon?
I'm like enthralled over here because that book, I just read it and it's just amazing.
And any comments?
Very much. I can't
any
wait.
Quick comments while we have a moment here? Your thoughts on it? Give a little bit of a book report on it?
The one of the books that, I love Helta.
Yeah.
But the John Lennon book.
Oh, thank you.
That
yeah.
That was my book. I read that three times and it was really good.
You're talking about the last days of John Lennon that we co-authored with James Patterson.
Yeah.
So, you know, we always surround ourselves with amazing talent. You know, there's no bigger name in the publishing than Jim Patterson. And, you know, once we sold him on the project of literally the last years of John and uncovering so much new information that we didn't know, and obviously exploring the runaway train that was Mark David Chapman, we had the great benefit of interviewing people like Paul McCartney.
Yes.
I mean, that's a pinch yourself moment in anybody's life. To sit down, you know, opposite your hero.
Wait, is that Sir Paul?
Paul McCartney?
It is Sir Paul McCartney, but he doesn't allow you to say that.
So. Okay, okay, okay. He doesn't.
But, you know, just to riff on that for 1 second, I talked to Paul, and Paul talked to me about the last time he spoke to John, which was just 2 weeks before John was killed on December 8th, 1980. It's a phone conversation from London to New York, and Paul called him because there was a baker's strike in England. And Paul had to make bread for the first time for his family. Now, John had been doing it for his young son, Sean, for years. So you've got the Beethoven and Mozart of their generations having a conversation. But they're not talking about music. They're talking about providing for their families. And I thought, what a beautiful memory, That's awesome. Lasting memory that is.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, Casey, I want to thank you so much, again, coming in and talking about such an important anniversary like the Boston Marathon bombing. Anything you want to say to close out, or any information you want to give to folks who may be looking for ways to buy new books or where some of your materials are, or follow you to see what you're up to next?
Sure. I think the best way to do that is just follow me on Instagram and Facebook. I feel like a young kid when I say that, but, you know, that's where the audience is. And I'm always very approachable. A lot of times I will get questions about, geez, I have a story. I want to be a writer. And I was that person 25 years ago. So I'm going to extend, you know, the liberties and the time.
Get
you
back.
Know, get, oh, you have to. That's it. And that's what you guys do every week. So just happy to be here. Thank you, Kevin.
Well, we appreciate you being here. And we're going to step aside. We only got one more segment left. I can't believe it. John Paul, car doctor, will be joining us in just a moment here on Monday Night Talk.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Each year, about 1 out of 2 men and 1 out of 3 women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than 2 or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced cancer care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally, with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard medical faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
Guys, fellas, men, are you Roman ready for the weekend? Right now, generic Viagra, a.k.a. Sildenafil, is just $4 per dose at Roman. Just complete a free online visit with a U.S. licensed healthcare professional. If medication is appropriate, Roman sends what you need in discreet packaging with 2-day shipping. Generic Viagra from $4 at Roman. Go to ro.co/bed. Do it today and get 20% off your entire first order. That's ro.co/bed.
Gain presents a tale of longing and long-lasting scent. Dear love of my life, we were on the 12B bus when I caught a whiff. A scent so fresh, so life-changing, I had to find its source. I didn't know if you were the woman in the pink freshly washed cardigan or the retired mailman next to me, but I knew one of you was my soulmate. Ah, the scent of Gain Flings. Add Gain scent beads for an even longer lasting scent.
By the middle of the week, so much news has come your way, you need your own team to sort it out. Lucky for you, there's Jared Valenzuela and the JV team to talk about the things you've heard and catch you up on some things you might not know.
I'm Jared Valenzuela. Join me and my guests as we have fun with current events and try to put things into perspective each week. Sponsored by Balance 7 Dietary Supplement and Corey Welch of Boom Realty. Catch the JV team every Wednesday night at 6:15 here on 95.9 WATD.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we are back. And we close the show out talking with John Paul. John Paul's been on Monday Night Talk previously. He now is a host every Sunday morning, I think at 11 a.m., taking your calls, The Car Doctor. John, welcome back to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Well, good evening, and thank you for having me here. I feel a little inadequate, though. I mean, we talked about the marathon. We talked to Dave Wedge. I mean, it's been, I mean, I feel like I got nothing to offer.
You have plenty to offer, because these days when people are, it's not easy to, how can I say this, find affordable transportation, maintain your transportation, and what you offer to folks who may not have depth when it comes to their knowledge of local mechanics, problems with their vehicle. Hey, should I buy a car that has 205,000 miles, or should I pass it over? You're the gentleman who's very valuable to our audience here, not only every Sunday, but on Monday Night Talk.
And, you know, what I've always said, and I've been doing this sort of thing either in, you know, AAA's publication or the newspapers or whatever the case is for a long time, and I like to think of myself as a second opinion kind of person. You know, somebody goes out and they go to their garage and, you know, maybe they say they need a cylinder head gasket or a brake job or whatever the case is. Mm-hmm. And then they call me and they say, well, based on this, this, and this, what do you think? And I'm going to be the one who gives them that bit of advice, and hopefully, you know, better than, you know, their, you know, favorite uncle or their bartender or whoever they look to for advice. Hopefully I can give them the right advice so they can get their car fixed and fixed properly, or if they're thinking about buying that car that might have a lot of miles on it but might have a lot of life in it, or maybe it's got a lot of miles on it and it doesn't have any life left in it. There's certain cars that you can take a chance with and some that you don't, because those you might find out that, well, that wasn't a good choice. So I try to give people that kind of advice, the same kind of advice that I would give you or, you know, anyone that I've known for a long time. And hopefully they, you know, if they listen to it, that's great. And if they don't want to, my feelings don't get hurt either. It's fine.
And I apologize for not introducing to you. I am surrounded by co-hosts. I have State Representative Kathy Lenatra is one of my co-hosts. And Peter Brown, he is not only my co-host, but he is a proud sponsor of Monday Night Talk. Peter and his family own Tiny and Sons Glass, so he is very well known. He knows his glass when it comes to automotive.
He does, and when I was in the studio one time with you, we chatted about glass.
We did.
And all about Tiny and Sons. Yep, absolutely.
Thank you.
So I open it. Do I, that's the purpose of this something. If we want to talk a little bit about used cars, I don't know if either you are in.
Well, the inventory. How's the inventory going now for used cars?
It's starting to come up a little bit. Prices are starting to come down a little bit. There was a little bit of a blip in car prices. They went up, well, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. But there's certainly a trend over the last 4 or 5 months, we've seen used car prices come down. The other issue is used cars happen when new cars happen.
Correct.
And I was talking to the service manager of a Nissan dealership, and he said he has 15 new Nissans on his lot where he would normally have 150 new cars on his lot. So because of that, there isn't any new Nissans to buy, so consequently there isn't any used cars to sell. Some of the big manufacturers like GM and Ford have sort of created their own auction scenario where they try to buy every car they can find so they can provide it to their dealers. And that's helped control the prices a little bit. But then you look at companies like Carvana that, you know, you see the commercials and they're like, oh, you have a, you know, 2015 Toyota Camry, you know, take a few pictures of it, we'll come and buy it. And they buy it for, you know, what might be a retail price. And I guess, big surprise, Carvana, you know, lost a whole ton of money, you know, in the last quarter, because they were, you know, similar to you know, I guess it was Zillow was buying houses and paying, you know, paying too much for them. And then they found out they couldn't sell them afterwards. So it's kind of the same thing happened with Carvana. Although I will say, if I had the opportunity and I could put that big coin in the Carvana vending machine to watch the car pop out at the bottom, I would give it a try.
When it comes to buying a used vehicle, whether you do, you go through a Carvana, or let's say if you're, maybe you're not necessarily looking in your local 25 to 50 mile radius. Maybe you might be somebody who, I think I'm going to buy a vehicle from South Carolina because usually the vehicles are a little bit cheaper. We don't have to worry about, well, I mean, we used to say this probably 5 or 10 years ago, but we haven't necessarily seen a lot of terrible winters where there's a lot of salt on the roads, but you would figure that low salt would mean there would be low rust on those vehicles. Is it, does that come at a cost if you buy a vehicle from out of state and you don't know what you're buying?
Well, I think low salt, you know, translates into lower blood pressure. But but as far as, as you know, buying a car well out of state, you still have to be really careful. Somebody I know just bought a 2002 Ford Thunderbird, and you know, nice Boulevard cruiser kind of car, unbelievably cheap, $3,000.
Oh, geez.
And they said, and they were buying it from Florida, and they went, wow, you know, it's a Florida car, it's great. They found out it had a salvage title. It was involved in a flood in 2006. In Massachusetts. So here's a car that was flooded out in Massachusetts, declared a total loss, somehow ended up in Florida, and this guy bought it. And realistically, and my answer to him was, for $3,000, put the top down, drive it all you can, and when it finally breaks, throw it away. Call it a disposable toy at that point, because you could get a lot of fun out of that car for $3,000 and enjoy it. And if there's some gremlins along the way, you know, you just kind of, you kind of leave it alone. But you still have to be careful. And there are some states that when the car gets registered, and that's where you know, companies like Carfax and other companies, you have to, you know, look at some of that stuff. If you see a car that's bounced around from state to state, sometimes what happens is the term title washing, because certain states, when they get retitled, all the past information goes away. So the title isn't branded that car was a total loss at some point. So you buy a car that has a Tennessee title or a Vermont title, and it looks good and clean, well, come to find out, it maybe was involved in a you know, California flood or something.
And that's where the Carfax comes in. And
very valuable. Carfax, yeah, very valuable.
Yeah, so we use that in our business, especially when we're trying to figure out, you know, if a customer has an issue with a water leak or something like that, we'll use that Carfax to check it out. But one of the things that in the used car market now is that when you buy a rental or a past lease car from a rental company, how are those as far as buying, you know, a consumer buying those as to a used car that get traded in?
Well, it's funny. Years ago, and it stopped in 1998, I guess, but I ran the AAA Diagnostic Center in Rockland. So yes, at the AAA headquarters, I ran their diagnostic center. And back then, when we would get former Hertz rentals and Avis rentals and stuff like that, they were outstanding cars. They were really, really good shape. Because back then, the rental companies only kept the cars for, you know, 12 or 15,000 miles. So granted, it may have not had one oil change in 15,000 miles, but realistically, it was in really good shape. And even though it might have had, you know, 1500 drivers in that time, it was a good value. Today the car rental companies are keeping cars 40, 50, 60,000 miles. And the other part of it is that some of the car rental companies, if the car is a Hertz or Avis or Budget or whatever the car is, and it has low miles, it might have low miles because it was damaged or it had a problem, and that's why it ended up in the auction market. So you still, you know, times have changed. And you know, today, if you go to try to rent a car, you go to go on vacation, a family vacation, you might spend $500 or $600 for the week to rent a car, where 5 or 6 years ago, you were spending $150 or $200 because the car rental companies have the same issue as regular people, when they go to buy 100 or 1,000 cars from the manufacturer, right, there just isn't enough cars out there right now. So because of the scarcity of cars, prices go up. There was a great story in the news of somebody who went on vacation in Hawaii. They priced out getting a rental car in Hawaii, and I think it was going to be $2,500 for the week. They ended up renting a U-Haul truck for the 7 days they were in Hawaii for like $150.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good idea.
Yeah, I mean, kind of odd to show up at a restaurant in a 14-foot box truck, but you know, you can take the leftovers home.
Let me ask you this: buying a used vehicle. You know, there was a time that I think if you bought one that had, you bought a vehicle that had 50,000, 70,000. Now, if you go on Car Gurus, you can search for those vehicles. High mileage vehicles, are they still worth the purchase, or is it foolhardy?
No, when things have changed a lot, and I always go back to the time when I was I was 16 or 17 years old, and you hung around with the car people of the time, mm-hmm. and I remember looking under the hood of it was a 1968 Pontiac GTO, and there was a bunch of old guys standing around staring at the hood, and by old guys I meant they were probably 28 or 30, but I was like, so what's going on? What's everybody looking at? And they said, well, this car's got 80,000 miles on it, and the engine's never been apart. Now, today, cars can go 200,000 miles, and the engine's never been apart. And years ago, not that many years ago, a car with 100,000 miles was at the back of the used car lot.
Right.
Today, a 100,000-mile car is at the front, and they say it's low mileage, yeah, because typically, cars can go 175,000 miles. I had the opportunity a couple of years ago to talk to a GM drivetrain engineer, and they were testing an engine and transmission on this weird-looking machine that looked like it should, go out into space. It spun things around, and it was crazy-looking. And I said to him, how much do you test the cars? What's the mileage number you look for? And they said we test our engines and transmissions to the equivalent of 175,000 miles. We want to know that they're going to go 175,000 miles without any major problems. So today you can kind of look at a car and go, 115,000 miles. Is it going to go another 75,000 miles with no problems? Probably. Is it going to go another 100,000 with no problems? Pretty good chance of that. And part of it has to do with better oil, better oil filters. People didn't like unleaded gas when it came out, but the idea of having unleaded gas, keeps spark plugs cleaner, maintenance is less. People are still, when I first started repairing cars a million years ago, people would come in twice a year for a tune-up. They come in the spring and the fall, points, plugs, condenser, distributor cap, wires maybe, air filter. Today, some cars you don't put spark plugs in for 105,000 miles. So cars are really a lot better. They last a lot longer. So if you saw a car with 100,000 miles or 120,000 miles and it was reasonably well-maintained and it wasn't used as a Lyft or an Uber vehicle or, delivering Amazon packages, chances are it's got another 100,000 miles in it.
Wow. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with John Paul. He is the host of WATD's Car Doctor Show this year every Sunday at 11 a.m. You can call in to him, 781-837-4900, every Sunday if you have questions in regards to whatever his topics are, whatever he's talking about, or if you have questions. One of the things I threw out there is a conversation, and that is finding a good repair shop. And I have to say, I feel it's getting tougher and tougher because depending on who you go to, and I had a mechanic I would go to, but he decided to sell his wrenches and go into another business. Mm. So then I'm like, all right, this has been my guy for the past 20, 25 years. I got to go to somebody else. And I've gone to some individuals who, their R&R specialist, where, we'll replace that. And they'll replace it. Wow, that's not it. We'll try this. Well, that's my money that you're playing with.
Right.
Either that or there are shops out there that go, I noticed your battery was a little low, so I replaced it and I gave you a top, and they upsell you. And nobody wants that. You want somebody who's going to tell you, give you maybe a little bit of a warning as to what your vehicle might be up against. John, how do you find a good repair shop? Is the Better Business Bureau the only way to do it these days?
No, and even the Better Business Bureau, what happens with the Better Business Bureau if they have a complaint? And I don't want to kind of cast a shadow over that.
Same here.
But, what can sometimes happen is the Better Business Bureau, somebody complains to them, and the owner of the whatever it is, it could be a garage, it could be a plumber, it could be whatever the case is, and they say, well, I went over and helped the person, so the problem went away. Well, there was a problem to start off with, so maybe that shouldn't have been the case. What I like to tell people is, word of mouth is the key. If you can, and, Facebook for what it is, and social media for what it is. If you live in Marshfield, and you belong to the Marshfield community page, put in there, who do people go to for a good garage? AAA has approved auto repair garages. Look for the ASE certification, the blue seal. Those are technicians that went out and voluntarily took a test to try to stay up with the latest information out there. But a couple of years ago, I was in a strange town I'd never been in before, and I needed to get some work done. And I went to a local garage, and it happened to be a AAA-approved garage. Well, that was kind of one of the reasons I went there. But I went there just for an oil change. That's all I wanted. I just wanted to get an oil change. And I wanted to see how I was treated on a relatively simple thing. And, were they going to try to upsell me on a bunch of stuff? Did they try to, and what I came away with was, they said, oh, well, your car was in here. We looked it over, and there's a CV boot that's starting to leak a little bit of grease. You're going to need to think about that. You have the muffler system that's starting to get a little bit rusty. It's on an 11-year-old car, so you would expect that. But no pressure, nothing like that. The oil change was done. Everything was good. It was a good experience. So if you're not sure and you go out and you ask some friends, go on social, look around, whatever the case is, go to the AAA website, AAA.com/repair. You can look for AAA garages in your area. However you're going to do it, start with something simple. Start with, go in and say, hey, can you rotate my tires and check the brakes while it's here? And see what it's like. That's when I used to do the AAA repair program. I would kind of hang around at the end of the day, and so I would go to a garage at 5 o'clock and see kind of the whole kind of interchange between the owner or the cashier or whatever the case is, and what the customers took away from that. And I would get kind of a gut feeling about, this is a garage that I want to have in our AAA program, or there were people that one after another said, what did you do? How come it's so expensive? Nobody wants that. People want to be treated the way they treat people. So, kind of look for a good garage that way. That's a good way. The other one is kind of look at the garage. Working on cars is a dirty job, but the dirt should be today's dirt, not last week's dirt and last month's dirt. So if you look around and you see a bunch of junk in the garage, or you look around the shop and you see a lot of cars in the parking lot that don't seem like they ever move, well, if they're not fixing those cars, chances are they're not fixing your car.
Oh, that's very interesting, that last statement. So I just have a question about an electric vehicle. I am thinking of purchasing one, and what are your thoughts on that? I know we've the charging station, and I also heard if you have an electric vehicle during the winter, you get less of a charge, so less mileage.
Absolutely, and you're one of about one out of three people maybe that are considering their next car to be electric. So you're kind of cutting edge right now.
Cutting edge, you hear that?
Yeah, cutting edge. And what happens is people look at variety of electric cars. And electric cars range anywhere from $35,000 to, $1 million, depending on what you want to buy. Tesla is obviously one of the most popular cars. The Chevrolet Bolt is a very popular car because in Massachusetts, you can buy that car for about $28,000. The last I looked, if you go through some of the discount programs like the Green Consumer, something like that, in Massachusetts where you can apply some of the rebates and there's some state incentives. But you're absolutely right. If you're going to charge up an electric car, the best way to do it is to have a home charging station, a home charging plug. Depending on how your house is set up, it might be a fairly easy installation, or you might spend a couple $1,000s to have a charging station installed at your house. If you're going to go out and buy a General Motors car, for instance, they will include the basic installation of a charging station at your house. And what's kind of nice, and people will say to me sometimes, oh, I have to plug my car in every night. Well, what do you plug in now? Your phone, your tablet, your laptop.
Everything.
You're plugging in everything. Why not plug in your car? And if you can do it relatively easily, now all of a sudden you plug it in your car and you're literally starting the day with a full tank of electrons. So, you know, unlike most people, if you look at, you know, everybody in the audience, and we'll throw Larry in there too, you know, people drive around with, you know, about a quarter of a tank of gas. Right. That's why AAA goes out and rescues people, because people don't pay attention to the gas gauge and they run out of gas. But if you can plug in your car every morning, and even if that car only has about a 200-mile range, most people only commute 50 miles a day at the most. So they're starting the day with a full tank, and they're, you know, easily able to recharge that overnight. If you don't have a home charging station and you're plugging into the electric outlet that you plug in your weed whacker to or something, it's going to take a really, really, really long time to charge up a car. I recently drove a BMW electric car, beautiful car, had about a 350-mile range. I drove it about 200 miles one day. It took 3 days to charge up with 110 volts. Now, if I had a level 2, the 240-volt charging station, like the thing that runs your stove or your electric dryer, it would have charged up overnight. So you really need to look at what fits your lifestyle and what works out best. And you're absolutely right. In cold weather, you can lose 30 or 40% of your range. But if you have a smart charging station and a fairly smart car, while it's plugged into electricity, you can say, well, I leave for work every day at 7 a.m. So at 6:30, I want the car to warm itself up. So you get in a car and it's warm. So now you're not using the heat as much once you're underway. And maybe even to reduce electric consumption a little bit, you shut the heat off, but you turn the seat heaters on. Now all of a sudden the seat's nice and warm, and you haven't really changed the range that much. The other part of it is really hot weather. If you're driving in 90-degree heat, you're going to also lose some battery capacity as well. So you kind of have to weigh all of this out. Electric cars aren't for anyone, and electric cars are a pretty polarizing topic. This past Sunday, we had a policy guy from Consumer Reports on to talk about, you know, what's going on with the EPA and you know, the electric vehicle push. And one of our listeners from Plymouth called in and said, you know, we're being pushed into, electric vehicles. And I'm like, you know, right now, it's the golden age of the automobile.
It is, yeah.
You know, you can go out and buy a gasoline car. You can go out and buy a 700-horsepower car that doesn't cost $1 million. You can buy a 700-horsepower Hellcat for, you know, under $100,000 and have the fastest car on the road. Or you can go out and buy a plug-in hybrid that gives you that electric range that you can plug in pretty easily and maybe go 30 or 40 miles on pure electric, and then it converts to a regular hybrid and gets, you know, 40 or 50 miles per gallon. Or you could just get a hybrid like a Prius and get really good gas mileage, or the new Maverick pickup truck. That little truck you can buy for under $25,000. It gets 40 miles per gallon. It's a hybrid, and it's a cute little truck, and it's fun to drive. So, you know, this is really the golden age of the cars, and you have a lot of choices right now. So don't let politics get in the way of it. Buy what you want.
So, John, we got like 2 minutes left. I did get a text message from a gentleman named John who actually asked about electric cars for people who live in apartments, thinking, and he's like, you know, someone who lives in the city. Quick answer on that, and then Peter has something super quick to ask, too.
There is legislation that will allow easier access to charging stations. If you live in an apartment and there's no access to charging, there's a fair amount of public charging, but our kind of surveys have shown that one out of five charging stations is not always working. So you kind of have to look around a little bit and make it work. Some condominiums now are actually putting in charging stations, and there's companies out there that kind of make it so they can actually make a little bit of money at it at the same time. So so there's some choices.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much.
Good job.
What a great segment. Yeah. And you're going to have to be a repeat offender on the radio show maybe in about 5-6 weeks to have you back on.
And maybe I get Peter on my show. We can talk about glass.
I think Peter would love that.
And make sure that, you know, after the windshield's put in, all that advanced
recalibration stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That'd be interesting. Yep. Yep. That'd be interesting.
I'll reach out.
Folks, be sure to tune in to John Paul every Sunday starting at 11 a.m. That's all the show we have this evening. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., you've been tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.